Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday the 9th of May, these are our main stories. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan is arrested on corruption charges in Islamabad. At his address to the annual Victory Day parade in Moscow, President Putin condemns the West. Also in this podcast, why a woman in Beijing has sued a Chinese hospital over fertility treatment. And Tom Hanks on turning his attention from acting to writing.
So often you just run out of curiosity for the job that you're doing. Sometimes what you have to do is you got to sprinkle some kerosene in the carburetor of your creative mind.
And we start in Pakistan. And that is the moment the country's former Prime Minister Imran Khan was led away, surrounded by dozens of paramilitaries, after his arrest at the High Court in the capital, Islamabad. Mr. Khan was at the court for an unrelated hearing on corruption charges, one of several court cases he's facing. Leaders of Mr. Khan's PTI party called for his supporters to take to the streets, and there have been reports of clashes in several cities, with police using water cannon and tear gas against activists. Chandana Gulzar Khan, a former commerce secretary with the PTI, said Mr. Khan's detention would not weaken the party.
In terms of leadership, there is no other Imran Khan. But in terms of party leadership, i.e. can we win an election? Absolutely. Because PTI now stands for Pakistan. Imran Khan symbolizes the freedom for Pakistan. He symbolizes a break from the slavish mentality we've become used to. Petty handouts for handing over Pakistani blood. So is there leadership? Certainly. We have some very good young talent people, some older people. We have plenty of people, but that's not the issue here.
Just before we recorded this podcast, our Asia regional editor, Itharajan Anbarasan, told us the latest.
The party of Mr. Imran Khan, they say that Pakistani rangers broke through the glass windows to detain him from the court complex, which they say it was completely illegal. They accused the security forces of abducting Mr. Khan. But the government says that Mr. Khan was arrested because he did not turn up for the notices issued by the country's anti-corruption watchdog, the National Accountability Bureau. This is according to the Interior Minister, Sana Ranaullah. The police made several attempts to arrest Mr. Khan on a different cases a few weeks ago, but that was prevented by hundreds of his supporters outside his home. And there is a real political crisis here in Pakistan at the moment. On the one hand, the country is going through a very difficult economic phase. They have just about $4.5 billion in foreign exchange reserves. That means enough to pay for 1 month of imports. Increasing attacks by militants in the northwest of Pakistan. And now Mr. Khan is pitted directly against the government as well as the military, because many people feel that this arrest would not have happened without the approval of military. But the military says that they are neutral and they are not getting involved in any of the political affairs.
It's hard to know how this is resolved. Just explain what could happen next.
No, this is in a very, very critical stage for Pakistan itself. You know, as you know, Pakistan's military is the one really calling shots in the country, even though there have been civilian governments that is very powerful. And Mr. Khan, in fact, in 2018, many people said at that time that he came to power with the blessings of the military, even though the military denied that. But they fell out later, and that led to his ouster in April last year in 2022. And then he accused the military of plotting against him. In fact, the whole background to the story was when he started naming a senior Pakistani intelligence army officer of alleging that he was involved in a plot to assassinate him, especially during the rally in November last year when he was shot in the leg. That really angered the military. Now, if already supporters are on the streets as we speak in the cities of Karachi, Lahore and Peshawar, and police were firing tear gas to disperse them, so this is going to aggravate the political tensions in the country.
Etherajan and Barasan. Russia's annual Victory Day parade in Moscow. The The event celebrates the defeat of Nazi Germany in the Second World War. But there was less military might and hardware on show than normal, with the country's focus on the conflict in Ukraine. There was heightened security and some parades near the border with Ukraine were cancelled. In his address at the parade in Moscow, President Putin accused Western elites of ignoring the past and sowing hatred.
They've forgotten who crushed that monstrous total evil, who formed a wall to defend their native land and didn't spare their own lives for the liberation of the peoples of Europe. Their aim, and there is nothing new about this, is to achieve the breakup and destruction of our country, cross out the conclusions of World War II, and conclusively break the system of global security and international law, and suffocate any sovereign centres of development.
Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg was listening to Mr. Putin's speech.
What we heard was the president repeat the alternative reality that the Kremlin has created over the last year surrounding events in Ukraine. For example, he said that against our motherland, once again, a real war is being waged. We have to remember that it was actually Russia that launched the full-scale invasion of Ukraine back in February 2022. He said that we want to see a future that is peaceful, free and stable. Once again, we have to be reminded that it was Russia that started this conflict. And when he talked about Western globalist elites provoking bloody conflicts and coups and hatred and Russophobia, he did address the participants of what he calls the special military operation. He said the future of Russian statehood and the Russian people depend on you. You are fighting for Russia.
Is there a sense in Russia, do you think, that people feel less safe now after Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
I think that there's definitely a sense of nervousness, unease across Russia, which has been building over the last few weeks, following the wave of drone attacks on Russian territory and on Russian-occupied Crimea, attacks that Russia has blamed on Ukraine. For example, attacks on fuel depots and airfields and energy infrastructure. And of course, following the incident last week on Red Square, the apparent double drone attack on the Kremlin, which again the Kremlin blamed on Ukraine and on the West. But as well as all of that, we've seen in the last couple of weeks bomb attacks on Russian electricity pylons, bombs detonated on the Russian railways to derail freight trains. What was interesting about the parade itself today on Red Square, I mean, we finally had the answer to the question so many people have been asking, will they, won't they, or will the Russian authorities go ahead with the parade on Red Square amid all these security concerns? They did, but it felt like a very different Victory Day parade from the one we're used to seeing on Red Square. Fewer soldiers, 8,000 compared to 11,000 last year, less military hardware, no modern tanks. Clearly, they don't have any to spare. No military flypast. That was cancelled. And the parade was shorter than in previous years.
Steve Rosenberg. On Sunday, more than 60 million Turks will vote in presidential and parliamentary elections that could be the most consequential in their recent history. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who has ruled for 20 years, is under threat. With just days to go before polling day, his main rival, the secular opposition leader Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, is narrowly ahead. Critics point to an economy in ruins and a fatally slow response to the devastating earthquakes in February, which, according to official figures, killed more than 50,000 people. Our senior international correspondent Orla Guerin reports now from the ancient city of Hatay in Antakya, one of the worst affected by the earthquakes.
By the side of a busy road, there is a new burial ground. It's a bleak spot. There are graves stretching out in front of me in long lines. The family has arrived. There's a grandmother, Fatia. She's almost collapsed on one of the graves. This is the grave of her son. If you had a chance to meet President Erdogan, what would you say to him?
I would say you killed us.
Do you think he will still be president after the election?
İnşallah çıkmaz. İnşallah ölüsü çıkmaz.
I hope to God he won't be elected president. What I want from the ballot box is his dead body, nothing else.
Fatia is angry, like many here, that on the president's watch, there were repeated amnesties for illegal construction. Developers cut corners. Many apartment blocks were death traps. In the heart of the disaster zone, in some places it looks like the earthquakes happened yesterday. This ancient city is now full of rubble and grief and empty spaces where entire buildings, entire families were wiped out. We've just met Ibrahim. He's 62. He's been walking through the rubble. Ibrahim, can you tell me what happened to you in the earthquake? How were you affected?
I have lost my older brother and my nephews. Our phones did not work. We had no internet. 5 or 6 hours later, I got the news of my brother's death. I heard he was under the rubble, but we could not reach him.
Do you think that President Erdogan bears any responsibility?
It's God's will that it happened. It should not be politicized. Our president did not cause the earthquake. Our president did his best.
Just across the road, we've been stopped by two women, Gözde, who's 29, her aunt Suheyla, who's 50. They were listening to our interview with Ibrahim and they disagree with what he said. Gözde, how do you feel about President Erdogan?
Benim az önce duyduğum şeyler çok zoruma gitti.
What I've heard really offended me. Nobody helped us in any way. We tried to reach our families. We reached their dead bodies hours later, days later. Were we in a different universe or was he? What he said about Erdogan definitely was not true.
In this polarized country, the earthquakes are one more fissure. Soon people here will vote against a backdrop of death and destruction in the south and an economy in ruins. After more than 20 years in power, President Erdogan is facing the fight of his life.
Orla Guerin. Israeli airstrikes have killed at least 13 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip in an operation the authorities say was targeted at militants posing an imminent threat to Israeli citizens. Several homes were hit and three commanders of the militant group Islamic Jihad were among the dead. In response, the Al-Quds Brigade, the military wing of Islamic Jihad, said resistance to Israel would continue.
Israel has committed a great crime and treacherous aggression against our people in the Gaza Strip by bombing residential areas and homes, which killed children and women and targeted the leaders of the resistance. We will make the occupation pay the price for this aggression on the Gaza Strip.
Our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell told us more about the Israeli attacks and why they were ordered.
So, yeah, there were these waves of Israeli airstrikes starting at about 2 o'clock in the morning local time, lasting for a couple of hours, concentrated in Gaza City and in Rafah, Khan Yunus in the south. A military spokesman said it was convergence of intelligence, timing and weather. The Israeli military said it carried out these precise strikes in response to the recent aggression on the part of Islamic Jihad, targeting senior officials, militant compounds, weapons, manufacturing sites for the militant group. And we're hearing at least 13 people were killed. The funerals are actually just now beginning. Four of those killed were Islamic Jihad commanders, we understand. One of them, a dentist, a civilian who lived close to one of those leaders. The remainder of the dead were all women and children, apparently the wives and children of those men. And also a large number of people have been injured. Coming out very specifically, the Israeli military is saying that of these three Islamic Jihad leaders, one was in charge of operations in the occupied West Bank, although he was based in Gaza, and at least one was responsible for the rocket fire that it said has been aimed at Israel in the past month.
Now, we heard there the Al-Quds Brigade saying resistance to Israel will continue. So is Israel now preparing itself for retaliations?
Yes, and there's plenty of signs that Israel is getting ready for a military operation that could last for several days. It's called up numbers of reservists. It's told people living close to Gaza, around 40 kilometres away from Gaza, to stay near to their bomb shelters. Schools in that area have been cancelled until Wednesday evening. I mean, if you look at domestic politics, there had been a lot of criticism. Of course, it's less than a week since there was a flare-up in which just over 100 rockets were fired from Gaza following the death in an Israeli prison of a hunger-striking Palestinian prisoner who was a member of this group, Islamic Jihad. A truce was sealed after about 24 hours. In that period, we also had the Israeli military bombing sites associated with militant groups in Gaza. There was also rocket fire during Ramadan after an Israeli raid at Al-Aqsa Mosque in the past month. So that all adds to the background of things being quite difficult. We've had these limited confrontations in that period. But, you know, the big question now is Hamas going to get involved? Because it was very embarrassing for them. You know, this is after last week's ceasefire, which was reached through mediators, the UN, Qatar and Egypt. And if they decide to get involved, that could lead to much bigger escalation. On the Israeli side, yes, there have been politicians on the far right who have been calling for tougher action in Gaza for some time now and a return to this policy of targeted assassinations against senior militants.
Yolan Nell. An exhibition of sculptures by Pablo Picasso opens today in the Spanish artist's home city of Malaga. It forms part of global events marking 50 years since his death, as Orlando Teal reports.
Picasso may be better known for his cubist and surrealist paintings, but the artist was a prolific sculptor, producing around 700 works in his lifetime. This exhibition, entitled Picasso, Sculptor, Matter and Body, brings together 61 sculptures he made between 1909 and 1964, a span of more than 50 years. Among the works on display are the reclining bather, made in plaster, and woman with vase, fashioned from bronze ovals. Other sculptures are made from what are known as found objects, everyday items Picasso put together to create his works. The exhibition is the first of its kind in Spain to be devoted exclusively to Picasso's sculpture.
Orlando Teal. Coming up, the Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak warns about the misuse of artificial intelligence.
Hopefully, we finally, agree on, regulations that basically say you do the bad things, you're out of line, you'll be punished and this and that.
We live in a time of information overload.
A flurry of disinformation.
Where things are not always what they seem.
Fake. It is fake news.
The Global Jigsaw is the new podcast from BBC Monitoring, shining a light on the conflicting agendas and narratives being played out in the world's media.
Narratives that slowly permeate the citizenry.
Where powerful interests are competing to influence your views. Search for The Global Jigsaw wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
A woman in Beijing is suing a hospital for not allowing her to freeze her eggs because she's unmarried. After losing the original trial and an appeal, she's been in court once again with a second appeal. Our correspondent Stephen McDonnell was outside the court.
Well, there's been a lot of attention on this trial because if Teresa Xu is able to win, well, it could potentially change the rights for all women in China. And what it amounts to is whether or not somebody who's not married should be allowed to freeze their eggs. 4 years ago, she decided the body clock's ticking. She wanted to freeze her eggs to potentially have children in the future. But a Beijing hospital wouldn't let her. So she's suing that hospital. And she hasn't been successful to this point. I mean, it is partly a morality thing because the government has, up until now, put all sorts of impediments on people who are not married in terms of them having children. And this has been just one of them. So if, like I say, if she hasn't had any luck yet, but if she is able to win at this stage, it would change everybody's lives in China.
Well, you say it's a morality issue, but different rules apply to men, don't they?
Yes, well, this is the strange thing. Men are able to freeze their sperm even if they're not married, and so she's been arguing that this isn't fair and how can this stand. I mean, the problem is that the hospital could argue, well, we don't make the rules, the government made the rules, and interestingly she's taken on the hospital rather than the government, partly because you wouldn't want to take on the government. You're on a hiding to nothing if you do that in this country. So tactically, it's been a smart thing to do. However, She may not have had any success this time, but I think many people think that eventually this is going to change, partly because the government wants people to have more children, whether they're married or not.
Stephen McDonnell. Could America be heading for an economic catastrophe? That's the warning from the US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen ahead of President Biden's meeting with US Republican congressional leaders to try to break the deadlock over the country's debt ceiling.
We should not get to the point where we need to consider whether the president can go on issuing debt. This would be a constitutional crisis.
If there's no agreement, the government could run out of cash by the 1st of June, sparking fears that America could even default on its debts. Here's our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
There's a new House of Representatives. Clearly, it's different every time. And we have been here many, many times over the decades. But we have Republicans, albeit a slim majority, in the House of Representatives. And they, in fact, passed a bill to raise the ceiling just recently, but included in the bill sweeping spending cuts over the next decade that you just referred to. And that is the stumbling block. Mr. Biden wants the ceiling raised with no conditions. And he said he won't negotiate over the increase and will discuss budget cuts only after the issue is resolved. So if anything, that is an area where there is some scope for compromise, but it'll be somewhere down the line. The White House says the president will make it clear that it's Congress's constitutional duty to act to prevent a default, and that's what Mr. Biden wants to see happen first.
Peter Bowes. The co-founder of Apple, Steve Wozniak, has warned that artificial intelligence is likely to make scams and misinformation harder to spot. In a BBC interview, he said anything created by AI should be clearly labelled and regulation is needed for the sector. He was speaking to our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
The trouble is AI is so intelligent, it's open to the bad players, the ones that want to trick you about who they are. Are they trying to sell you something you don't want? Are they trying to trick you to get your account information? You know, we see malicious intrusions all the time, both personal and companies that get intruded and millions of accounts get, you know, exposed and all that. That's only going to, I would only expect that to become worse of a problem than it is now. Let's be careful about how fast we're proceeding. When we first invented the internet, what if we saw today and issues of spam, for example? What if we had designed the internet with some protocols that absolutely avoided spam?
Do you think regulators are going to get it right this time, you know, nearer to the beginning?
Oh, I do not think so at all. I think the forces that drive for money compared to the forces that drive for caring about us, for love, for feelings, for emotions. I think the forces that drive for money usually win out. You know, it's sort of sad.
If you were in charge of regulating AI, what would you do first?
Anything's published with AI, you as a reader should be told this was created by AI and I'm posting it to you. And the person who posted, and even the massive global broadcasting media that posted, should have some responsibility.
Do you think it's just a trend, AI? Or do you think it's going to be the big game changer?
I think it's going to get better in what it's able to do. And hopefully, we finally, you know, agree on, you know, regulations that basically say you do the bad things, you know, you're out of line, you'll be punished and this and that. Especially to the big companies that feel they can kind of get away with anything.
We've got legislation coming here in the UK, which is calling on companies to be able to access messages that are end-to-end encrypted if law enforcement wants to or needs to. What do you think about that?
That's a hard one. I don't always have the same response, but pretty much I'm on the side that we should be able to encrypt. I should be able to whisper in a friend's ear without anyone knowing what I'm saying. I should be able to talk to my wife without anyone knowing what I'm saying. And now it's all known. And I don't think that that's right as human beings. You know, what should we be? The other side is there are a lot of crimes possible on us now. And those crimes are using the internet to kind of hide data. When you want to hide, it's usually because you feel that what you're doing is wrong. So I don't know. The trouble is, do you trust any large entity like a government to have a back door so that everything you're sending in email and all that is visible? I don't know if the government's who we want to trust.
Steve Wozniak speaking there to Zoe Kleinman. When you think of the Netherlands, windmills may be one of the first things that come to mind. More than 1,000 still exist, and many of them are in good working order. But there's one windmill just north of Amsterdam that has a unique job, as Tim Allman explains.
Vermeer's Girl with a Pearl Earring is one of the most famous and iconic paintings of all time. It showcased his skill, his technique, and his use of colour. But where would a modern-day artist looking to use authentic 17th-century techniques go to get their paints? Well, there is one place you might try.
We got 1,200 windmills in the Netherlands, but one is for paint supplies, and this is the only one.
Every morning for the last 42 years, Piet Kempenaar would bring this centuries-old windmill, called the Cat, into life. Two massive grinding stones weighing 10 tons would crush rock into powder, creating coloured pigments. Techniques that date back around 400 years, creating paints like ultramarine blue that were incredibly valuable, according to Peter Pelkmans, art tutor at Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum.
It was the most precious colour that was existing as a pigment. And the story goes, which sounds very interesting, and I think they can prove that it's right. It was as precious as gold.
Vermeer spent most of his life in Delft, but he did serve his apprenticeship in Amsterdam. Who knows? Maybe he picked up some of his paints from a windmill, just like the Cat.
Tim Allman. And finally, he's one of the biggest movie stars in the world and now also a novelist. Tom Hanks' narrative is called The Making of Another Major Motion Picture Masterpiece, and it's published today. It's about a multi-million dollar superhero movie, and it draws heavily on the actor's own experiences in Hollywood and the film industry. Our arts correspondent Rebecca Jones spoke to Tom Hanks and asked him why he wanted to write a novel.
I'm going to say I probably made three or four movies in the course of writing the book. And when it comes down to the full encompassing 100% effort that goes into showing up and making of a movie, the human condition needs a release from that never-ending pressure. Because so often you just run out of curiosity for the job that you're doing. And the effort of the long grind, sometimes what you have to do is you got to sprinkle some kerosene in the carburetor of your creative mind, and you just have to have some other reason to spark your imagination. And sometimes it has to come from outside the work that you're doing.
You're a first-time novelist. How many rejections did you get for your novel?
I'm sorry to say. None. But, you know, come on, I'm a bold-faced name, and just that alone gives me cuts and lines that is not fair. I will give you that right now. Despite the name on the front, it's going to live and die based on its own ability to entertain and enlighten an audience. So that rejection can still come at the hands of the consumer.
One particular actor in your fictional film is very difficult. He delays and disrupts filming. I'm assuming he wasn't based on you, but you must have...
Don't be so sure, Rebecca. I have pulled every single one of those moments of behavior myself on a set. Now, I also pride myself with showing up on time and knowing my job at hand and having an idea. But I've had tough days trying to be a professional. When my life has been falling apart in more ways than one, and the requirements for me that day is to be funny, charming, and loving, and it's the last way I feel. Now, what cannot occur on a motion picture is that someone cannot monkey around with the timing or the length of the shoot or the budget. And yet, I say that is a cardinal sin in the motion picture business. You will be amazed at how many people know that they can get away with it and are told that they can get away with it because they are carrying the movie on their shoulders. And that happens on occasion.
We talk at a time when publishers feel the need to censor problematic references or language. Should we be retroactively changing the words of dead authors like, for example, Roald Dahl and Agatha Christie?
Well, I'm of the opinion that we're all grown-ups here. And we understand the time and the place of when these things were written. And it's not very hard at all to just say, you know, that doesn't quite fly right now, does it? Let's have faith in our own sensibilities here, as opposed to having somebody decide what we may or may not be offended by. Let me decide what I am offended by and what I'm not offended by. I would be against reading any book from any era that says abridged due to modern sensitivities.
What next? Another novel?
That would be nice, but you'd have to talk to me in another 3 or 4 years. But the wanting to sit down and create, it's just the best way to spend one's time outside of being with those that you love and make you laugh.
Movie maestro and author Tom Hanks, charming Rebecca Jones, and the rest of us. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Ricardo McCarthy. The producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Exploring the events shaping our lives through original documentary storytelling.
We'll hear arguments for Roe against Wade.
The documentary from the BBC World Service is a window onto the wider world.
The security situation in Europe has changed in the last couple of years dramatically.
Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.